Welcome to the College Commons Podcast and our acclaimed author series, a partnership between HUC Connect, the online learning platform of the Hebrew Union College, and the Jewish Book Council, featuring conversations with authors recognized by the National Jewish Book Awards. My name is Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to the College Commons Podcast and our interview with Jordan Rosenblum. Jordan D. Rosenblum is the Belzer Professor of Classical Judaism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the current director of the Mossi Weinstein Center for Jewish Studies. His research focuses on the literature, law, and social history of the rabbis of antiquity, in particular on rabbinic food regulations. His most recent book is Forbidden, a 3,000-year history of Jews and the pig, which received a Jane and Stuart Weitzman Family National Jewish Book Award in the category of Jewish food writing. Jordan Rosenblum, thank you for joining us on the College Commons Podcast, and congratulations on your award.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
If I were to summarize your argument, I'd say that you're channeling René Magritte, who famously provoked his viewers with a painting of a tobacco pipe and the phrase written above, "Ceci n'est pas une pipe," this is not a pipe. Which is to say, the idea of the thing is not the same thing as the thing itself. In Forbidden, you ask us to appreciate the degree to which the pig in Judaism is much more than an animal. It's a universe of ideas, a signifier that means more than just edible or inedible, kosher or treif. In fact, I think it's fair to say you go so far as to say that as one of those ideas, the pig serves as what you call a byword for Jewishness itself, but in the negative, by which I mean a pig's presence defines the absence of Jewishness. My mind, when I read this, immediately went in a different direction, namely wine, which also serves as a shibboleth for Jewishness or non-Jewishness in the religious history of Judaism. So I'd like to ask you, how do wine and the pig serve as a byword for the very identity of being Jewish, and how do they serve that purpose differently from one another?
I can say that I'm a good person to ask about this because the book I wrote before this was called Rabbinic Drinking, which heavily featured discussions of wine in rabbinic literature. So I have thought a little bit about these. And what I would say is that in some ways they are connected. Jews have, from the ancient to the modern world, interacted with wine, and wine serves central roles in Judaism. Jews and non-Jews have used wine to talk about Jewish identity. There's a fascinating story in America with the temperance movement, the sort of secret history of Welsh's grape juice, and why kosher wine comes to be sweet wine in America has a interesting story that kind of connects to that. But what I would say is that the difference here is that throughout the discussions are wine is on the table, but the question is what kind of wine and what roles it can or can't play. And when we're talking about pig, even the texts that put pig on the table, it's fraught in a very different way, because even those who are putting it on there to make a statement about Jewish identity or non-Jewish identity are doing so with the full knowledge that it should be off the table. Whereas wine can or cannot be kosher. Pig never has that possibility. And so they play similar roles at certain times if we expand out far enough, but I would say there's an interestingly different story there.
You have titillated me with this promise of a good old American Jewish story, so tell us the Maisa.
There's a lot to it, but to give the Aleg Lecha, like the on one foot example, I would say that Jewish communities have always made their own wine. This is because, going back to rabbinic texts, there were concerns about wine being libated to idols, poured out for idolatrous practices. And so Jewish communities would make their own wine because of certain concerns about buying wine from non-Jews. And so wherever they moved around the world, there would be someone, and often many people, making wine. And they come to America, and there's a need to make wine for ritual purposes. And a lot of Jews immigrated to the Northeast. And the variety of Concord grape that grows well there produces very sweet wine. So Jewish wine has not always been necessarily as sweet as it comes to be in America and mostly associated with it. Now, the temperance movement, the Christian temperance movement, it's important to add that word to it, comes about in America. And first, they believe that Jews don't drink wine. They think Jews are completely temperate. And then they discover that, you know, number one, many Jews enjoy more than one glass, but ritually there is a liturgical and ritual purpose to have wine. And so therefore the claim that Jews don't drink wine at all was wrong. And then the movement very quickly turns against Jews, and there's a complex story of anti-Semitism there. But at the time, though, there are many Jews who are growing Concord grapes in that region to sell to Jews for kosher wine. And there's a family, the Welsh's family, wants to have a non-wine grape juice as an alternative to alcohol. And some of the families that they bought from were Jewish families who were growing those grapes for that. So it's interesting that Welsh's grape juice has a story behind it, as designed to be a great product that wasn't alcohol. And this movement that first tried to embrace Jews, but their stereotypical, non-connected to reality vision of what Jews were or weren't, came into conflict with the reality. But then they purchased grapes from these Jewish communities. And this is where I would connect it to the story, right? It's a moment when expectations of what Jews internally and externally act becomes part of the story. And this whole other economic, social, religious, cultural movement is influenced by that.
There's an interesting parallel I'm picking up in this story about this quality of wine, whereby it could go either way. It could be kosher or unkosher with all of the attendant implications. Also kind of applies to Jews themselves, who can often pass as non-Jews, about whom there's some skittishness in the non-Jewish world. And there's skittishness on the Jewish side too, because they're balancing their internal or tribal instincts against their desires for integration and access, which is the way wine works for the Jews as well.
Let's tie back to what you opened up with, the artist of This Is Not a Pipe. There's a well-known scholar of a religion, Bruce Lincoln, at University of Chicago, and I assigned a book chapter of his to my students that I really like, where he opens up with that piece of art and a few others like it to talk about the idea of symbolic inversion, where you're sort of taking the symbol and you're inverting it and you're using the power of the symbol and flipping it to make a different statement. Definitely with pig, you see that a lot, where the pig stands for one thing and then it means it so strongly. But if you flip it, it could mean Christian identity. It can mean a transgressive or alternate Jewish identity. It's the symbol. And then there's inverting the symbol and the power that that brings.
The power of the inversion is directly proportional to the degree in which the thing itself is expected to be mono, not polysemous.
Exactly. I'm not interested in food just for the sake of food. I'm not interested in drinks just for the sake of drinks. I'm interested in them because they're such mundane experiences. All humans need to eat, and all humans choose to eat with cultural patterns of avoidance or embracing, of looking at something as a symbol of community or self. So if you look at food, you get to all of these bigger questions: social, religious history, religion coming into contact with other religions, and different identifications playing out on the plate.
I want to point out that for all the scholarly research behind the book, it's wonderfully written and playful and a real romp. So thank you for that. In the second century BCE, Antiochus Epiphanes, the villain of the Hanukkah story, tried to force the Jews to eat pork and renounce what he called, and what you cite as, their xenophobic laws.
Yep.
And elsewhere, I think it was Tacitus, I'm not sure, who called the Jews misanthropic, meaning antisocial in that case. Mm-hmm. Is the pagan view of Jewish standoffishness more generally about the naturally segregationist power of dietary restrictions and their limitations on socializing in general, rather than specifically about the pig? And if that is the case, if it's their sense of the broad category of kashrut in general as being a kind of segregationist impulse that turns the pagans off, if that is the case, why is the pig in the pagan Jewish relationship so emblematic?
So what I'd say is there's no one the pagan view, right? The same way that there's no one the Jewish view, etc. But there's a couple of trends in Greek and Roman thought. And one of them that you were talking about was this claim that Jews are xenophobic, that they have this fear or hatred of the other, that misanthropic, where they hate other humans. And they cited food rules. All right, Tacitus also used this quote as the title of my dissertation, where he says, they sit apart at meals, right?
Right,
he
right.
talked about Jews separating themselves. And Jewish food laws can do that. Any food laws can do that. Someone says they're vegetarian, and then you have to ask some questions. My son is 10 and a half. He is an ardent vegetarian for several years. He decided this himself one day, and he's sticking to it. But when you really ask him, it turns out he's a pescatarian. So right, he will eat right. fish, but only some fish, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to ask all these questions. And what that does then is you have to plan around it all the time. Same thing when you talk about kosher laws, right? An argument I often have with my family, they'll say, so-and-so is very strict about the kosher laws. And then I start to open my mouth and everyone stops because they know what I'm going to say, which is I say, it's not about strict, it's having a different interpretation because there are multiple ways to interpret the laws. And claiming one is strict assumes that there is a degree from righter to wronger. And my argument is, for thousands of years, the question has been, what is your interpretation versus what is mine versus what is someone else's? So what you're seeing is some ancient authors had what a scholar Peter Schaeffer has called like simple ethnographic observations that say, oh, isn't that interesting? Jews have these food laws. Not positive, not negative. But then there is a trend among some that were setting them apart. Now, if you go and look at other Greek and Roman texts, they use lots of food things to separate themselves too. The term barbaric comes from the Greek, barbara, it's a very much a negative term.
Right,
and
right.
they made fun of people who drank milk. They wouldn't eat with certain people. They wouldn't eat certain foods. So they're noticing in that. Now, pig comes out, I argue, because if you're observing from afar, Jews following biblical and what we know of various Second Temple, right, roughly the mid-500s BCE to 70 CE in that period. If you look at Jews who are observing the food laws as we've seen the varieties that we gather from evidence that were observed at that time, pig is the most common meat that they wouldn't be eating. They'll eat goat. They'll eat sheep, cow. These are commonly consumed. They might slaughter it differently or prepare it differently, but the meat is the same, right? But pig, which particularly Romans very much appreciated, it was the most commonly eaten meat that wasn't kosher. And so when you have to get to the fine grain level of nuance, that doesn't make for a good sarcastic comment. You need something that's very obvious. And this pig thing is so obvious. And what I argue in the book is you start seeing emerging in this time period that both Jews and non-Jews are starting to say, hey, there's something to this pig thing. And it seems to be that it's the most obvious case to do that. But it's to, as you say, it's to get at these other things. When they claim Jews are xenophobic or misanthropic, they're showing us that they have larger assumptions about Jewish practices and people. And they're projecting it onto the pig.
Okay, so let's talk about the internal Jewish relationship with the pig and some of the complexity there. The frontispiece of your book is a delightful image that challenges the very title of your book with a Yiddish poster encouraging pork production. It says, Der Chaser is unser Hauptmaschine ab zu produzieren Fleisch in die 90. Jahren. Mm-hmm. Pork is our best engine for meat production in recent years. This is a modern secularist manifesto for economic liberation of the Jews, but it doesn't pretend not to be transgressive. It understands that it's pushing the cultural envelope. In the early and pre-modern periods, Jewish transgression around pigs was of a very different tenor than this poster's transgressive approach to pigs. Walk us through, if you would, the very, very different ways in which Jews engaged in transgressive behavior around pigs in different time periods of Jewish history.
Well, let's start with that poster. Okay. It's from 1931. And what you have there are Jews who are trying to show they're good communists. And what do you need to do if you're a good communist? You throw off the opiate of the masses, religion. And how do you show that you've thrown that off? Well, you're a Jew. What represents that symbolic inversion of Jewish identity, right? The pig. And so you engage in collective pig farming, a good communist enterprise. But there's the irony there that to show you're not a Jew anymore, you're not beholden to Judaism, you raise pigs to show you're a communist. But that only is interesting if you remember that you're a Jew. It's like the psychologists call this ironic processing theory, where I tell you, don't think of an elephant. So you have to think, let me think of a water bottle. And then your mind says, is a water bottle an elephant? No. Okay, so I'm not thinking of an elephant. So right, to forget, you have to remember. And there's an irony there. So that's what I see happening there, is to show that they're not beholden to Judaism anymore. They choose a symbol of Judaism to represent that they're no longer Jewish, which reminds you that they're Jewish. It only shows that they're not by reminding you that they are.
The effort to negate anything is as much an affirmation of that thing as would be the affirmation itself.
Exactly. The more you say this is not a pipe, the more pipiness it has.
Right.
So that's one example of that, that I find to be profound. The other was, I found that there is sort of a subgenre of Jewish autobiography that's been coming out the past couple of decades of what I call OTD, memoirs off the derech. So Jews who were born into often Hasidic or ultra-Orthodox lifestyles and families, and then left the community and had to negotiate that rupture and find meaning and sort of rebuild up an identity, often a Jewish identity and a different Jewish identity. I've been working on this book for about 20 years. So I've been collecting pig references for 2 decades. These memoirs would at some point mention an interaction with the pig. It's rarely at the very beginning. Part of that narrative has to be that there's a moment, particularly those who were born in those communities, who had never ate pig before. It's a Rubicon, or maybe if we're talking about food, you say like a Rubicon, right? Crossing that Rubicon kind of bifurcates life into the time before and the time after eating pig. One of the first reviews that came out about my book was someone who was very turned off by what they perceived as me lauding the fact that there are Jews who eat pig and seeing it as a super positive thing. And I kind of laughed at that because I was like, this person clearly didn't read my book well, because my argument isn't, it's neither good nor bad. It's just interesting. And he was proving the point where I said, people kind of write that off and say, oh, Jews who do that, they're not Jews, they're not to be considered. But actually, if you start reading the accounts of many of them, like back to the communist posters, back to many of these OTD memoirs, they're using that moment to reinterpret their Judaism. They're doing it Jewishly, and it's always a negotiation of their Jewish identity. So to say that, look, they did that, they're no longer Jewish, I'm not even going to think about them, is missing a complex discussion. And so again, it's neither good nor bad, but it's interesting, and it's part of the story, and it's not going away. If you don't consider that, then you're missing a picture. It's not good or bad. It's just interesting.
Okay, personal question.
Yeah.
Were you raised in a family that had dairy dishes, meat dishes, and treif or unkosher dishes?
So I had family members that did that. And I had family members that kept no kosher at all. And so it would depend on what house I was in.
Jews love to tell stories about themselves or their family members who have this setup whereby they have scrupulously preserved kosher dishes side by side with segregated, patently bacon dishes, right, and high treif. And Jews love to tell that story because they love to laugh at it as an example of absurd inconsistency and kind of ridiculousness and the wishy-washiness, the vagaries of human emotionality and all that. I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat the pig, but I think it makes perfect sense to have a treif set of dishes, just for the record.
Yeah, so I don't take a stance one way or the other on it. What I do say is, just like I was saying with the pig, if you write that off and say, oh, that's not someone who keeps kosher, right? You're missing a complex discussion about what food means for people. And you're going to only paint an historical record of people who thought one way and miss a whole variety of Jewish experience.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
Let's talk a little bit about the Gentile-Jewish relationship in the far distant past, specifically the Romans and the Jews. We're going to go back to them. You describe how when the Romans put down the Jewish revolt in 70 CE and definitively destroyed both the temple in Jerusalem and Jewish national autonomy, that they, the Romans, they weaponized the pig. You offer, in fact, a picture of a silver denarius, a Roman coin minted shortly after the Jewish defeat. And on this coin's reverse side is a pig with piglets. And you point out that historians suggest that this pig on this coin, this emblem of national sovereignty of the Roman Empire, actually refers, at least in part, to the Jews' recent defeat. I would like to ask you to zoom out from that experience of the pig and the Jews and ask a more general question. How does a distinctive religious scruple of self-denial and standoffishness become a vulnerability for a minority community?
In this case, when you're dealing with a bully, they're looking for anything that they could mock, right? Like, think of the things that when you were a child, people made fun of that, like, later on might not be so silly, right? Like, I have glasses, you know, called four eyes as a kid, right? But then you become older and then, like, you know, someone wearing glasses is seen as distinguished and intelligent and, right? So symbols change over time. What we're seeing in those texts, though, are multiple layers of things where, number one, it just so happens that the Roman legion that put down that revolt had the boar as a symbol. But never miss a great marketing opportunity / joke / pun / moment to ridicule your opponent. And that's what you're seeing there. And it's a coincidence that both rabbinic figures picked up on and used it to see as a symbol of their awfulness, and that Romans picked up and saw it as a symbol of their awesomeness. And what you're seeing there is that negotiation where someone, in a sense, predetermines what their decision is going to be about someone, and then they interpret the evidence in that light. If you're either looking to find every reason to hate the Romans, we can find it there. If you're looking for all the reasons to hate the Jews from a Roman perspective, you can find it there. And again, my point is, the pig is the centerpiece of this argument, no matter what perspective you're looking at. It's at that time that the symbolism of the pig was really starting to explode.
One allied issue with the pig and all that it represents is the phenomenon of religious impurity. And the question of religious impurity often raises a ton of downstream questions of the transferability of this conceptual religious impurity, of which the pig is one major example, as we've discussed. This potential transferability of impurity can be terrifying at worst, if one imagines a given unit of impurity is infinitely transferable, then, you know, watch out, because it's everywhere. And even if it can only be transferred to one degree or in very limited fashion, it's still inconvenient. And indeed, rabbinical Judaism has spilled a lot of ink on this issue of the transferability of impurity. How does the transferability of the pig's impurity play out in some of your examples?
Let's zoom out for a second and say, in rabbinic texts, you see, they're uncomfortable even using the word pig. They start to refer to it as devar acher, like another thing. They use euphemism for it. So it seems that they're not only uncomfortable putting pig in their mouth in terms of the food, but even having the word pig formed in their mouth. And the fear of that keeps growing the more you move away from it. And the more attention you give it and weight you give it, the more it means. And so there are tales of people even making reference to a pig and having social pressure put on them by a rabbi. There are texts that talk about the technical abouts of impurity, but the thing that I found about pig that's interesting is, and again, to go back to my previous book, I talk about that in terms of beverages and ritual impurity, and they do spend a decent amount of time discussing that. But when it comes to pig, they're so nervous about it that they want to avoid it entirely.
You offer some really wonderful examples of Jewish transgression of the prohibition against pigs. Choose one, the most entertaining, the one that's going to entice the most readers to read your book, of Jewish transgression in relation to pigs.
If you look at the cover of my book, there's a delightful drawing of a pig on it. And when my publisher asked me, do I have an idea for an image for the cover? I said, I don't care what you do with it, but I want this pig on the cover. And that pig was drawn by Isaac Bashevis Singer, famous Yiddish author, Nobel laureate. And he drew it because he would sign his name by drawing a pig. And this is the first example we have of him doing so. And he was writing a postcard to Melech Ravitch, a well-known Yiddish poet. And interestingly, they were both vegetarians. So they didn't eat pig because of that. But yet he drew his signature with a pig. This very clearly identified Jewish poet. In fact, in that postcard, he writes, Shenem Denk, you know, thanks a lot. Ish bin ein, I am a, and he draws a chazer, a pig. And I love that because he's writing in Yiddish to a Yiddish poet steeped in secular Jewish culture. And there's no world in which you do not identify Isaac Bashevis Singer as having a strong Jewish identity. But he's choosing to sign his name by drawing a delightful little pig. And what I see that as is the transgressiveness of that, right, is he wants to bring on that contrast. He's clearly playing on that pig, marking him as a rebellious, transgressive, complicated Jew, but a Jew nonetheless. So I guess the one I would point to is not one necessarily of Jews eating, but that pig drawing represents so much to me. To me, it's the most Jewish pig drawing I could find. And it's a great pig drawing.
So from cover to cover, take us out on the interview with an example of something that surprised you in writing this book. Despite the fact that you've been researching this topic for a long time, presumably you know a lot, but maybe something came out of the woodwork that really stuck with you.
So I expected to find a lot of anti-Semitism related to the pig. I note in the book that the chapter about Middle Ages was really hard for me to write because, you know, each day you'd come in, it was just anti-Semitism after anti-Semitism. But I guess what surprised me is seeing how much in the early modern and modern period that continued in different ways. And I would find these poems written about Jews and the pig that are jaunty, funny reads, but awful in what they're saying. There's one that I mentioned in the book, but I chose not to use the image of, which was I had been writing this book on and off for a while, and then pandemic hit. And I put a pause on all my research because I was just trying to be, you know, an administrator and a teacher and a parent and a husband and a human, right? And there was just wasn't time for research. And then it took me a little bit to get my sea legs. And then it was about a year and a half before I started to actually start getting any research done again. And as I was starting to get research done, I came across the fact that there were debates, just like there are modern debates about vaccines, that claimed that vaccines were a Jewish conspiracy. Now, if you go on the internet today, you'll find that similar things exist at this moment, these sorts of things. And I found an image of Jews being depicted as pigs to mock them and state that vaccines are a Jewish conspiracy. And finding that image in a moment when vaccines were a major public debate and anti-Semitism being connected to some of these was in the public eye. I'm a scholar of the ancient world. I'm used to living in long precedented times. I'm used to having 1500 years at least to digest the events that happened. And so seeing such a direct connection to things you could stumble across on the internet that were written that morning was jarring for me. I'm not used to being that relevant. A struggle too, because it goes from being a funny story, you know, and oh, well, there were these awful times, but that was in the Middle Ages, to seeing direct connections to moments, not just in my lifetime, in my, you know, previous week. That was hard.
I appreciate that difficulty, and I think it resonates with the times, unfortunately. But On the positive note, I want to return to your relevancy, which I did feel. I found the book an absolute delight to read. I congratulate you again on your well-earned recognition as the recipient of a National Jewish Book Award. And most of all, Jordan Rosenblum, thank you for joining us on the College Commons podcast and for the pleasure of your company.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.